So the reading is from Matthew chapter 2, verses 13 to 18. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more.
Thanks very much, Paul. If you could keep that open, that would be a help to me. We're going to be looking at those verses together. Marcus began by starting off with this topic of home. And when we use the word home, I wonder if there are certain images that brings to mind. What does it evoke? What emotions for you? And I think that the feelings associated with that word, home, are what drives some of us halfway around the world to visit those communities where we're born. There's something, I think, even about the landscape of home, which seems to have an effect on us. It seems to call us home. For me, it'll be different for each one, but for me, it's the hedgerows and those wide East Anglian skies. And as I approach, it has an effect on me. But there's something also pretty elusive about this idea of home. I know lots of us look forward to the approach of Christmas, that family gathering where we eventually receive all that warmth and love that we crave. But actually, even where our family experiences are positive, and of course very often they're not, these events can be crushed under the weight of our impossible expectations. So why is this idea of home so evocative, so powerful, and yet so hard for us to fully experience? Well, the writer C.S. Lewis, he puts it like this. He says, "Our lifelong nostalgia, our longing to be reunited with something in the universe from which we now feel cut off, to be on the inside of some door which we have always seen from the outside, is no mere fancy, but the truest index of our real situation." So he's saying that we long for home, but we never seem to fully find it. And the Bible actually explains to us why that is our universal human experience. And the Bible also explains why Christmas, or the events of the first Christmas, is the key for all of us to finding our way back to our true home. But before we get into that, there's some pretty sobering realities in these verses which might be hard for us to take, but they're crucial building blocks for understanding our way home. So do hang in there. And the first one's there on the sheets. It says, we are part of the problem in this world. I've been to two nativity plays this year, one at a nursery, one at a school, and they're brilliant events. I don't know if you've been to one lately, but whichever characters they major on, and it's different each time, but maybe the wise men, maybe the shepherds, they all seem to have the same ending. So it's everyone gathered in a big tableau on the stage with Joseph, Mary, and the baby in the manger. And actually, that might be, lots of us find that image charming in lots of ways, but for lots of people, I think they're left thinking, well, so what? And actually, for a lot of people, that might be the last they think about Jesus for another year, until it comes around again. Mentally, he's left there in that manger. It's an endearing idea, perhaps, but basically irrelevant. Or for others of us, it's not that we forget about Jesus, but if we're honest, the message of Christmas seems a bit over-familiar to us. We can't seem to get that excited about it anymore. And I think that part of the problem for us is that we don't read on in the nativity story to discover the context into which Jesus came, which is the verses we just read. And the context is rather more disturbing. This is certainly too sinister to make it into any nursery or school production, what we just read. And understanding this dark backdrop to the Christmas story is actually exactly what we need to allow the light of Christmas to impact us fully. So this section of the story we're looking at today, do open it if you haven't, if you've closed it in between, Matthew 2 and verse 13. This event we're looking at is after Jesus is born, after the star, after the gold and frankincense and myrrh, and the clouds are just beginning to gather on the horizon. So let me read from verse 13. Now when they, that's the wise men, had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." It's pretty shocking, isn't it? So far, we've discovered, and we have been looking at Matthew's gospel, we've got to this point so far, we've discovered that this child is like no other child before or since. We're told he's Emmanuel. That is, he is God himself come to be with us. And here we're discovering that this baby is entering a world which is far from positive about his arrival. In fact, before this child has done anything at all, the national leadership wants him destroyed. The small group of people on this planet who know that he's arrived and understand who he is, understand that he's the rightful king over humanity, their first instinct here is to get rid of him. They find his very presence a threat. Now, that is highly significant. I guess different ones of us will have different ideas of whether we're optimistic or pessimistic about human nature. And it's difficult, isn't it? As a race, we seem to be capable of such heights of achievement and heroism. And over the last fortnight, we've been celebrating the life of Nelson Mandela, which encapsulates that. But we've also seen, haven't we, such depths as well of cruelty and injustice. And we see that in the evils which Mandela had to overcome. But the Bible tells us that what really defines us as human beings, as a race, the defining, exposing moment, is that when it came down to it, we rejected our Maker. So in verse 16, we read this horrific account of how Herod's hatred of Jesus was so intense. Verse 16, he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. It's a murder attempt. But the point is, this attempt to kill Jesus, it isn't a one-off. It's actually a foreshadowing of what's to come. Because as we read on in this gospel, ultimately, when the opportunity does arise, we succeeded in crucifying our Creator. Now, you might think, well, this is a bit heavy, a bit extreme. Sure, there might be one or two bad eggs here and there. But in general, aren't we basically good? But part of the shock of this passage is that what Matthew's doing is he's focusing in here on what should be the very best of humanity. Long ago, if you know the Bible, you'll know God declared that it would be through one man, Abraham, and through his offspring, that the Jewish nation, that blessing would come to the whole world. And Israel, this nation, are a case study of what happens when the best of humanity are given every possible privilege and spiritual advantage. And yet even they, who had been sent prophet after prophet, telling them to get ready for God's coming, even they rejected God when he came. Verse 14 says this, "And he, Joseph, rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, 'Out of Egypt I called my son.'" It's a very interesting verse. This verse is actually a shocking condemnation of Israel. Initially, that statement, "out of Egypt I called my son," initially that was made about the nation of Israel, God's own son, being called out of slavery in Egypt all those years before in Moses' day. And yet now, when the true Son of God arrives, Jesus himself, everything is upside down, everything is backwards. So this nation, Israel, has become a spiritual Egypt. The king of Israel has become a new Pharaoh. So we see him here destroying defenseless children, just like Pharaoh did when Moses was a child. And Jesus, the true Son, he needs to escape not from Egypt, but to Egypt. Do you see the shock of that verse? Matthew's teaching us that the very people who were chosen to be part of the solution in this world, the Jewish nation, are actually, like everyone else on this planet, part of the problem. Even the best of humanity, we're learning, are part of the problem in this world. Some here will have seen it already, I'm sure. But last month, the second film in the Hunger Games trilogy came out. And it became the highest, or the sixth highest grossing film over its opening weekend ever. Hunger Games has been called a modern day Lord of the Flies. Because both stories are a study of how normal people, given the right circumstances, are not really as nice as we like to think we are. And actually how we're capable of all kinds of savagery and brutality. I read recently an article about mob behaviour and how it is that crowds of people in the Balkans or in Rwanda, and in this study also in British and American cities during the riots, how these groups' behaviour can suddenly transform from peace into violence and looting. And the sociologists report that these people aren't weird, they're not abnormal, it's not as though they lose their minds either when they're in the crowd. But in fact, people in mobs usually remain entirely rational. And they make decisions in exactly the same way that they would normally. The only difference is the context. And as it becomes obvious that there's going to be no consequence to their actions, then for the majority of people who are normally law-abiding, looting and worse become the obvious ways to behave. Why not? You see, most of the time, you and I can convince ourselves that we, and most of the people around us, are basically decent people. But what the Hunger Games is exploring, and what these studies are showing, is that actually we're not as good as we like to convince ourselves. And like Israel here, far from being the solution to what is wrong in this world, particularly the way we relate to our loving Creator and his rightful rule over us, that actually reveals that we're part of the problem in this world. Now, this is sober teaching. And the second dark reality that we need to come to terms with to grasp the brightness of Christmas and to understand our way back home is number two there. We are alienated from our Creator. Let me read verse 17. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children, she refused to be comforted because they are no more. Now that's a quotation from the prophet Jeremiah written 600 years before Christ. And the verse from Jeremiah, which Matthew quotes here, is about how the mothers in Israel, and they're personified here as Rachel, who was Jacob's wife, how these mothers wept when their children were dragged off into exile. The place mentioned here, Ramah, was 6 miles north of Jerusalem, and captives from Jerusalem were marched through it. It was a kind of transit camp as they were taken on their way to Assyrian or Babylonian captivity. And Matthew's saying here that the tears of exile, which began all those years ago, all those centuries before, continue to be shed even now in Bethlehem, over these children that Herod has just killed. So we began thinking at the beginning, didn't we, about this idea of home. It's so powerful for us and yet so elusive. And that is exactly what this verse is about. It's telling us that even though these people are physically back in the land, back in the promised land, these tears here testify to the fact that spiritually, they're still in exile. They're still far from home, spiritually. And the Bible explains to us why that is the universal human experience. The Bible tells us that human beings were created to be in the garden of God, a place with no parting from love, no decay, no disease, a life lived in the presence of our holy Creator. And I guess we know what happens next in the Bible story. Because we chafed under God's authority, because we wanted to live without his interference, we were banished, we were exiled from the garden. And we have been wandering as spiritual exiles ever since, living in this world which no longer fits our deepest longings. Imagine if you were shipwrecked from a spaceship wrecked on the moon for a little while. And if that happened to us, it would be immediately obvious from the moment that we tried to draw our first breath and started to suffocate that the moon is not home. Actually, if you think about it, our experience on Earth is not really very different. We still die, only more slowly here on Earth. And this truth came home to me again with added clarity this week as we were mourning Bethany's death. You see, this world is no longer home to us. It's no longer as it should be. So though we long for bodies which run and don't grow weary, we've become subject to disease and aging and death. Though we were made for a love that lasts, all of our relationships, even the best ones, eventually end in death. Though we long to make a difference in this world through our work, we experience endless frustration. We never realize our hopes and our dreams. We spend our lives in various ways trying to recreate this home that was lost. But actually, our true home only exists in the presence of our Heavenly Father, the one on whom we've turned our backs. And this theme of alienation and exile is played out again and again in the Bible, culminating in the exile in Babylon. But even when the people eventually return to the land, as we see here, the homecoming fails to deliver that full reunion which the prophets had promised and which everyone was longing for. And that's the backdrop. That is what Jesus came to this earth to bring. That is what Christmas is about and why it's such wonderful news. I put on the sheets there. Jesus came to bring us home. Now, many centuries before this event, God delivered baby Moses from Pharaoh's massacre of the Israelite infants. And you can read about it in Exodus. And God did that so that in time, Moses could rescue the people from their exile in Egypt and bring them home to their promised land. And in these verses in Matthew, we're discovering that Jesus is this one that Moses was always pointing towards. In this passage, God delivers Jesus from Herod's massacre of the infants. And he does it here so that Jesus, the true Moses, can rescue the whole world from our spiritual exile and bring us home to live in a recreated universe with God forever. So Jesus is the true Moses. He has come to bring us to our true home. And at Christmas, we celebrate the fact, don't we, that Jesus was placed not in a royal cot, but like in those nativity plays, he was put in an animal's feeding trough, far from home. And in this passage, we see that Jesus himself was exiled in Egypt. And throughout Jesus' ministry, he wandered. He settled nowhere. As he said, "Foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." So Jesus remained completely outside of the social networks of political and economic power. He didn't even seek for academic or religious credentials. Finally, at the end of Jesus' life, you may remember, he was crucified outside of the city gate. He was rejected by the community. He was exiled. And as he died, he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" So Jesus was exiled and cut off from God himself. He was expelled from the presence of God the Father. He was thrust into the darkness to experience the full horror of spiritual alienation. So he took upon himself that full curse of human rebellion, which you and I deserve. And he did it so that he could bring us home. So the Bible tells us that the end of history is going to be a feast of homecoming. Jesus is going to make the whole earth our perfect home once again. And so for those who trust in Jesus, we will no longer be living east of Eden. We'll no longer be always wandering but never arriving. We will come home. And the Father will meet us and embrace us. And we will be brought into the feast forever. And actually, we can start to experience home even now. Psalm 90 says, "You have been our dwelling place." God himself is our eternal home. And therefore, we can visit our true home even now. As we come to God in prayer and as we commune with, as we delight in the one for whom our souls were made. I don't know if you remember the film E.T. Each one of us is like E.T. in a way. We pine for home, that place where we're safe and secure and loved. And the reason is because we've been built collectively with this distant memory of Eden. So imagine for a moment that you found out that fish were always dissatisfied with being in an aquatic environment. That would hint, wouldn't it, that they were made for something else. As Pascal, the French mathematician, put it, what else does this craving, this helplessness proclaim, but that there was once in man a true happiness, of which all that now remains is the empty print and trace? And so many of the things in life that we pursue are attempts to soothe this homesickness. So the idyllic holiday or the perfect relationship or the dream job or the ideal house. But actually these earthly things were never meant to cure the homesickness. Actually they only provoke it, they arouse it. And they point beyond themselves to our true home. When I was growing up we had a golden retriever at this dog. He was adorable but very dim and thick. And if you're playing with Mops and you pointed upwards to the moon or something like that, Mops would always just look, be transfixed by your finger. She'd never think to look beyond to what you're actually pointing towards. And sometimes we are a little bit like that. You know, we get transfixed by the earthly pointer without looking beyond it to that greater reality that it was always signalling to us. And it's that greater reality that we'd say desperately need. Now, sadly, in London, particularly in the summer months, homeless people are often forced to live in the parks. And when people are forced to spend all of their time in a park, it's pretty obvious that the situation does not work and the parks deteriorate quickly. Now, parks are brilliant. They're beautiful places to visit. But they're not designed to sustain the whole weight of a human life. And it's exactly the same for us. Our careers, our families, our friends, these are wonderful gifts to us. But they cannot bear the full weight of our souls. These things are not home. And until we recognize that, and until we make our relationship with God, getting it and cultivating it, the most important thing in our lives, we're always going to feel like we're travelling and never arriving, like it's always winter but never Christmas. And this restlessness that we have is actually a great gift. It's a great blessing to us. We've been made like homing pigeons. We've been given this instinct which draws us onwards to find and enjoy our real home, God himself. So if we find Christmas a little bit samey, if we find it a bit over-familiar, it might be because we just haven't looked closely enough at this dark context that we've been reading about, into which Jesus came, and this amazing mission that he came to accomplish, bringing humanity home. So amidst all the busyness of this time of year, let's be those who take time to delight in the one for whom we were made. And if we are blessed in the next few days, as some of us will be, with times of family and celebration, let's let these experiences drive us forwards and to think about our true homecoming and that ultimate celebration to which all of this is pointing us towards. In a moment, we're going to sing again this song, which talks about the reversal of the curse and the joy that Jesus has come to bring. But first, we'll have a moment's quiet to think about what God's saying to us through these verses. And then when the musicians start, we'll stand and sing together.